going for the marker.
My name is Tay Tompkins. I'm with the Chapman from Flinders University, and I'm the chair of this session. There's only two of us speaking. There should be plenty of time for each of us and time for good questions. But I wonder if someone would volunteer to be the timekeeper, please. Somebody with a watch. Good, thank you very much. What's the time now?
That's now on my mind 10 to 4.
10 to 4. Well, we've got sensibly till 5. So that's an hour and 10 minutes for both of our talks and questions. So say, what if we say once they have 25 minutes each?
It's 20 minutes and 10 minutes question, and then...
I might not get through my paper in 20 minutes.
Oh, all right. Nor might I, but...
We'll do our best. So if you could tell us when 20 minutes is up.
Yeah.
I'll give it just for that, and then you can finish up as you can.
Okay. And so let me introduce Ajahn Sujatha, who is the abbot of Santa Monastery in Bundanoon in New South Wales, and who is also the secretary of the Australian Thunder Association, and is going to speak to us as well. Former. Okay. And he's going to speak first.
If you could, I'd be able to borrow someone's watch, that'd be terrific, and then I can just keep an eye on the phone. Okay, is it okay if I sit down? So, thanks very much, Venerable. I'm sure by this time in the conference, we're all kind of our brains all full of information and so on, so we don't want to try to absorb too much. I'm here to talk about the role of women in Buddhism, and particularly women in monastic Buddhism. And I might remark that I'm quite astonished, actually, in this conference, how few papers there are that actually address questions of gender. I find it quite astonishing, if not perhaps a little disturbing, considering that it's supposed to be about religion in the Asian Pacific region, and all of those mainstream religions in that region are characterized by very strong patriarchal structures. And the renegotiation of these structures is one of the defining debates of our times, and yet it's hardly been addressed in this conference. So I hope to redress that a little bit. The title of the paper is Dark Matter, which has puns on a number of levels, but actually comes from the statement made by somebody who was reading a paper, I think by the Chancellor of the Hamburg University, when I was there for a conference a year and a half ago. And what he said was, when he was reading the paper, what he was supposed to say, he was supposed to be drawing the connection between religion and modern times and saying, well, we're living in a fast-changing environment and we have to shift our understanding to keep pace with scientific progress and so on. And he said, for example, the physicists have recently found out that 80% of the universe is composed of dark matter. But actually, that's what he's supposed to say. What he actually said was, the physicists now say that 80% of the university is composed of dark matter. So, of course, this was a delightfully Freudian slip, and everyone enjoyed that. But for me, that really captured something about that particular event. Now, to go back and give the background for what that particular event was quite a significant thing shift historically, but there was a conference called by the Dalai Lama to discuss the question of bhikkhunis and reintroducing the bhikkhuni lineage into Tibetan Buddhism. Okay, so for those of you who don't know, bhikkhunis are the fully ordained women renunciates, so fully ordained nuns. And they don't exist in Tibetan Buddhism nor in Theravada Buddhism, the kind of Buddhism that I follow, but they do exist in the East Asian forms of Buddhism, Vietnam, Korea, Taiwan, China, and so on. So then the question is, can we or should we reintroduce the lineage of ordination from those countries into the Tibetan and Theravadan tradition? And the Dalai Lama has been supportive of this for a generation, since the early 80s, and yet nothing's happened. So this, there's a lot of hope pinned on this conference. There's a mass of papers presented both by monastics and by academics on this, and it's very interesting to see how the academics were playing a very active role, not just in recording what was happening in Buddhism, but in actually promoting social change within Buddhism. And all of those papers address all of the kind of the legal issues, all of the historical issues, social issues, everything like that, and it was all very positive. The Dalai Lama gets up and gives a very positive talk at the end of it, all about women's rights, equality, and so on, and very supportive. And but there's this kind of one little nagging issue, and they put us at lunchtime with the Dalai Lama. So we were sitting with about 10 of us, the monks, and the Dalai Lama at lunchtime. And I said, you know, Your Holiness, how can you make a decision to reintroduce the full ordination lineage? How do you actually decide to do it? Not do you want to decide to do it, but how do you actually decide? And he said, I also do not know. So this is the where the crux of the matter comes from. Even the Dalai Lama doesn't know how to do it. So then we go back, there's a big panel, 20 or so monks and nuns, everyone reads their thing, everyone's supportive of bhikkhuni ordination, we've all been invited, they've all come to Germany to advise the Dalai Lama what we should do, and we all say, let's go for it, let's do it. And one of the nuns there, one of the Taiwanese nuns said, the Taiwanese nuns are very kind of feisty, and they're kind of the terror of the Theravadan monks. They say, you know, if you introduce nuns into Thailand, you know, we'll become just like Taiwan, where the nuns are running everything and we have to do what they tell us to do. So one of these Taiwanese nuns says, I'll accept any decision His Holiness makes except more research. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So His Holiness then says, more research. Yeah. And nothing happens. And nothing happens because why? Because he can't make a decision? Because there are a lot of things going on behind the scenes that we don't know about. Yeah. And so this is where that idea of dark matter comes from. And he, the Dalai Lama, referred to his words he used were these narrow-minded monks. Okay. Now, and so of course, there's tens of thousands of Tibetan monks, all these lineages, huge monasteries, all of this kind of structure and so on, and much of it is completely opaque to us. Okay? And this is something I wanted to just draw attention to, or, you know, spark some discussion about, is the nature of the debate. Like, how can the debate be carried forth, or what kinds of things can we say and we can't say, and to whom can we say them? So I'll talk a little bit more about that, but I'd just like to ask, how many people here are familiar with the issues around ordination in women in Buddhism? Anyone familiar or not familiar? Roughly familiar, a few people, some people not familiar at all. But I'll just give you the basic background to what happened, and you get some idea of the tensions that are involved. When the Buddha taught, he established an order of bhikkhunis, of bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, fully ordained monks and nuns, and he always described his dispensation as being comprised of monks, nuns, laymen, lay women. That's what we call the fourfold assembly. And so you see that's a very kind of balanced pattern, yeah, the male and female aspects and then the spiritual and the worldly aspects, yeah, renunciation aspects and so on. And so that's quite a balanced pattern. Now, our evidence of the early evidence for the bhikkhuni movement is very ambivalent. And on the one hand, we have a significant number of very, very powerful testimonies from the nuns themselves, where they, you know, they say things like, I'm freed, I'm so well freed from the three crooked things, I'm freed from the mortar, the pestle, and my crooked husband. Mm. Yeah? And so we have these things, you know, we have another one where one of the nuns is meditating alone in the forest, which is a pretty radical thing for a nun to be doing. And Mara, the tempter, comes up to her. Okay, so Mara is kind of like the Satan figure of Buddhism. He's a very powerful demon, and he comes up to her and wants to tempt her. And he says, aren't you afraid of that rogues are going to attack you? Yeah, you're just alone here, a woman alone in the woods. Yeah, aren't you vulnerable? And he says this to Upalawana, he's chosen the wrong nun to say it to. And she says, Mara, she said, even if 1,000 rogues like you were to attack me, you couldn't disturb a hair on my head. He says, on the contrary, I could just disappear right in front of you, fly up into the air. I could make myself so small I could walk up and down inside your eyebrows and you wouldn't even know that I'm there. Yeah? So this is the voices of the women that we're hearing from this time. Or another time when Mara accused the one of the nuns, he said, how can you hope to attain the wisdom of contemplation? You're just a woman. Yeah? Women have Dwanguli Panya is two-fingered wisdom, right? You can't grasp things properly. You can only kind of, yeah? So this is the women's wisdom. It's like two fingers. This is Mara talking, yeah? The evil one. And then her reply is, you know, when the mind is purified and concentrated and one has wisdom, then what has that got to do with being a woman or a man? Yeah? Anyone who thinks I'm a woman or I'm a man, then Mara, you go off and talk to them. Yeah? So these are some of the voices of women that we get very kind of loud and clear through authentic early texts of Buddhism. And these aren't kind of, this is not the legends that are passed down through the schools or anything. These are actually what the original canonical texts are saying. Right? But they're also saying some quite other things. And we also have the story accepted by the traditions as the story of the founding of the Bhikkhuni order, where Mahapajapati, the Buddha's stepmother, comes to the Buddha, asks for ordination. He says no, 3 times. She goes off. The Buddha travels to another city. She and her ladies, her followers, shave their head, put on robes, so that they're being very transgressive, they're being naughty, right? They're doing what the Buddha told them not to. They follow behind the Buddha. He refuses them again. They stand outside the gates, weeping, yeah, covered in dust from the journey. Yeah? And Ananda, the Buddha's favorite disciple, asks what's the problem, and he takes their cause to the Buddha and persuades the Buddha. He says, okay, I'll allow them to ordain, according to this particular story, which is widely distributed in the early Buddhist texts, if they accept these 8 special rules, rules of respect, the first one of which is that a nun who's ordained for 100 years must bow down to a monk who's ordained that very day. Right? So this is a particular rule which, for some reason, monks don't have a problem with, and all of these Western feminist radicals think that there's something wrong with that. So this is a rule which was, and then the Buddha said, if the women hadn't ordained in Buddhism, it would have lasted for 1,000 years, but now that the women have ordained, it's only going to last for 500 years. Like a disease called red rot that blights the sugar cane, like the disease called white bones that ruins the crops, yeah? So too is the entry of women into our religion. Yeah? So you have quite a powerful set of contesting images and ideologies about the presentation of women within the earliest Buddhist texts. And so, of course, what that means is that for people in modern times, well, we're quite free to pick and choose which ones we think are important and to say, well, this is the Buddha's real attitude, yeah? Just briefly recap on the history of what happened since then. The nuns order flourished for 1,500 years in India, went to Sri Lanka very early, and in 423, I think, the Sri Lankan bhikkhuni Sara travelled with the ship owner Nandi to China and established the bhikkhuni ordination in China. And from there, the bhikkhuni lineage has spread to Korea, Taiwan, Japan, Vietnam, and so on. So all of the existing continued bhikkhuni lineages comes from there, from India to Sri Lanka, from Sri Lanka to China, from China to these other places. The bhikkhuni lineage was never historically dubious, but in any case, it's not recognized as being an established part of historical Buddhism in Thailand and Myanmar, and similarly in Tibet. Okay, so in those countries which don't have the bhikkhuni lineage, they have more or less invented an ad hoc system, different systems in different countries that will allow some platform for women to take up a renunciate lifestyle. But these are always on a very, very subservient level, where they're effectively acting as the domestic servants for the monks and these kinds of things. Now, within the early Buddhist texts, and I've mentioned that there are some which appear to give a very subservient role to the nuns, but it's also important to remember that there are also many others which protect the nuns and which stop them from being put into the subservient role. For example, there are rules which prohibit monks from getting nuns to do their laundry for them. Right? So you can see the kind of relationships that would be likely to have emerged, and which are in fact found in monasteries in Thailand and so on, where, you know, I've been in a Thai monastery, and the nun there, the Meichi, is like saying, you know, I'm visiting a monastery, I'm trying to find somewhere to wash my robes, and she says, I'll wash them for you. I say, no, I just, if I wear some laundry, I just wash the robes, I'll wash them for you. Oh, please, you just show me where the laundry is, I will wash them for you. All right, okay. So you have these, you can see these very human dynamics, the very realistic dynamics found in the vineyard. So there were rules to prevent, you know, the monks from exploiting the nuns as domestic servants. You can't use them as your cooks and your, you know, domestic cleaners and things like that. So around, perhaps it seems about the 12th century, the Bhikkhuni order disappeared from Sri Lanka due to probably the wars and famine and strife that was there at that time. It was never revitalized until the present day. And so, of course, with the intermingling of the different Buddhist traditions and our increased awareness of feminist issues, and then there's obviously a widespread call for the re-establishment of the Bhikkhuni order throughout those schools of Buddhism that don't have it. And so this is, of course, one of the things that I've been involved with on many levels, from the practical level of building a monastery and training nuns to the theoretical level of doing textual research and so on, engaging in dialogue internationally and various kinds of things. Now, one thing I want to come back to is the question of the nature of the dialogue on this, and perhaps somebody might have some suggestions for me, because it's you know, something I wanted to talk about, because something I don't have an answer for. And I mentioned before about like this idea of the kind of the dark matter, and of this kind of dialogue that there isn't actually any dialogue about the issue. You see, I can come to here. Right, so we've got a kind of a secular academic environment, international environment, and I can talk about these things and people will come and listen to them in a sympathetic way. But of course, with the exception of a few exceptional monks like Venerable and, you know, a small number of monks, it's difficult to engage with the monastic community on those things. So like the conference with the Dalai Lama, it's a big conference, a big international conference, but hardly any monks showing up. And so they basically don't participate in the dialogue. Now, if you, for example, if you Google bhikkhunis, you'll find dozens or hundreds of mentions and articles about bhikkhunis, almost all of which are very positive, right? Yet we know that, you know, the vast majority of monks actually go in Theravada, we know, we think we know, they don't want to have bhikkhunis. And yet that view is not expressed through that medium. Right, so the medium of the internet is an international, modern, technological medium, and that discussion is not happening there. So there's one discussion happening in that level, another discussion happening within the monasteries, and they aren't actually communicating. And I can't bridge this gap. You know, I can't do it, because I don't know how to. And I was discussing this with some bhikkhunis the other day, and these were very senior Tibetan bhikkhunis, and they say that there was one meeting where bhikkhunis was discussed by some of the senior Tibetan lamas, and at that meeting was Sakya Trinton, who's the head of one of the four Tibetan lineages, and he said afterwards that he couldn't really speak up because he felt afraid. Yeah? And I said, what do you mean afraid? And they said, well, in Tibet, they typically, they they kind of let things ride, they don't say anything, and they debate, and then they kill you. Right. So he made a phrase of his life, yeah? So it's certainly not the case that all monks in any tradition are opposed to bhikkhunis, and in fact a lot of the leaders, interestingly enough, a lot of the leaders of the traditions are actually very supportive. And just a few examples, my own teacher, Ajahn Brahm, who's probably the most well-known monk in Theravada monk in Australia these days. Bandi Gunaratna is the senior Theravada monk in the States, a very well-known international teacher, very supportive of bhikkhunis. Kesri Dhammananda, the recently deceased chief high priest of Malaysia and Singapore, very, very respected senior monk, very supportive of bhikkhunis. The Sangharaja of Cambodia, the head monk of all of Cambodia, he's personally supporting a community of 20 bhikkhunis. The acting Sangharaja of Thailand has said in private to my teacher Ajahn Brahm, there's no objection to doing bhikkhuni ordination overseas, if you're going to go ahead. So it's not certain, and there's many other examples. You know, Bhikkhu Bodhi, the very well-known, respected American scholar and translator. So there are many respected monks and leaders from the communities who do support this and who articulate that support, and yet there's still this dark mass which seems impossible to kind of penetrate. Now, one of the things that's going on with that is that, in a sense, on one side, like the dark side of it, if you look at it, is to say, well, they've got all the money, they've got all the real estate, and they've got all the status, the prestige. They don't have to say anything. Yeah? As Venerable was saying, he raised the question at a conference in Hanoi, yeah. And what happened?
Well, there were two rectors of different universities in Thailand who were talking about the wonderful Buddhist education that they were offering. But, you know, most men are only ordaining for the ritual 3 weeks and not staying. And so they don't quite know what to do with this wonderful education system. So I put my hand up and said, maybe you have the same problem as the Catholic Church. Have you considered offering full guardianship of the Dharma to Thai women and also the education to Thai women? And he said, I can't talk about that. And that was the end of it.
Oh,
gee.
I guess in the position that I follow, I guess one thing we seek is a non-duality. I don't know about other traditions.
What tradition?
Zen. And that's one of the basic things in Zen is non-duality. And surely there's a prime example
of
duality.
Yeah.
When you discriminate between just because you're of gender.
Yeah, but you have a thing like a kind of ideological trickle down effect, don't you? Whether doctrines of non-duality are actually applied in the world is another matter. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Dogen came out very strongly against discrimination against women. He said anyone who looks down on women is a fool and doesn't understand the Dhamma. Yeah, and so he made some very strong statements about it. But still happens all the time in certainly Japanese Buddhism. So this is one side, okay? And we can understand that it's pretty straightforward, yeah? You know, the monks own the monasteries, they have the prestige, they have all these things. They want to hold on to it. And they see that as a good thing because they are maintaining cultural continuity. And that's very important to them, cultural continuity. They see their institution and what they're doing as a preservation of ancient, say, Thai culture or whatever it is, which has been threatened on so many times by modernity. Yeah, so, you know, they've been so damaged, yeah, and so there's been so much attack on their values and their lifestyle and so on, that they really feel that they're doing the right thing by preserving that. And they might be, and they often may be very humble about it. They may admit, well, yeah, we know this isn't actually perfect, it's not what the Buddha taught or anything, but it's all we've got. Yeah? So this is sort of moving into another way of looking at it, which is not necessarily that you've got a kind of a dominant patriarchal elite who are kind of lording it over everybody, but what also, that's true to some degree, but what you also have is a group of men who are actually very scared and very vulnerable. and who feel very threatened, and who wouldn't come here to speak at a gathering like this because they couldn't, and they'd be afraid to, and they couldn't communicate, they wouldn't understand. Yeah? And so they feel very threatened by modernity, and they don't know how to respond to it. The male sangha in Thailand, the last figures that I've heard, has gone from 400,000 monks to 180,000. Yeah? The Sri Lanka has gone from 40,000 to 10,000, yeah, in the last few years. Yeah? So it's in a state of rapid collapse, and the reason for that collapse is basically that there's a loss of meaning, a lack of relevance. They don't know what they're supposed to be doing anymore. And together with the fact that there are more opportunities open. So if you want education, if you want career and so on, there are plenty of other things that you can do. So that the monastic lifestyle is shrinking a lot, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it certainly feels threatening when you're within that environment. So here I come along, and other monks and so on who are trying to, you know, we want to support women's practice. And then we get involved in all of these kind of political machinations. One of the interesting things that I've noticed is that I often seem to trigger, I don't know whether it's just my personality or what, but I often seem to trigger more reactions from other Western monks than from, say, Thai monks. This is my experience recently when I went to Thailand in February and I visited my home monastery at Wat Manachar, and the abbot of that monastery started haranguing me and threatening me in public about my support for bhikkhunis. What you're doing is threatening the existence of our tradition. You don't know what you're doing. This is so dangerous. Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, chill out, man. You know? And I went to, I then went to see his teacher, the Thai monk, the head of our lineage. And I told him, he said, oh yeah, how many bhikkhunis have you ordained? I said, oh, we haven't ordained any yet, we're thinking of doing so. And I told him that the acting Sangharaja, the acting head of Buddhism in Thailand, has said, oh, it's no problem to ordain bhikkhunis overseas. And he said, oh yeah, that's normal, yeah. Yeah. So he was basically just, you know, very equanimous. And when I saw my meditation teacher, Thai meditation teacher, he said, you know, Sujato, he said, oh, I was very, very pleased, you know, it's made me very happy. He said the reason he's supporting nuns is because he doesn't have any discrimination. He's very even-minded. And so the response that I heard from the Thai monks was basically either equanimous or gently supportive of what we're doing, from individual Thai monks, yeah, which is quite different from the impression that you get of the kind of monolithic position of the Thai Sangha, which does it exist actually? I've tried and can't find any actual statement by the Thai Sangha with any policy on bhikkhunis. Right? The Burmese Sangha does, you can find it on the web. Anyone who supports bhikkhuni ordination is going to burn in hell. Right? That's the official position of the Burmese Sangha, right? Thai Sangha, what do they say? I can't find it. I asked Bhikkhuni Dhammananda, who's the Thai Bhikkhuni. She's been an academic for most of her life and so on. Surely she must know. No. She's never heard of any official statement by the Thai Sangha on bhikkhuni. And again, it's the opacity of this. There's no actual statement. How can you question it if it doesn't exist? Yeah? And so this is where it gets very kind of very sticky and very hard. So I don't know what to do about this. I mean, I keep on talking about it, I write about it and so on and so forth. But I know that all the wrong people are listening. I know that if I talk, you know, you guys are probably sympathetic to what I'm saying anyway. And so I don't know how to create a kind of dialogue which is going to be more inclusive. So maybe some people have some suggestions about that. So I notice Anton's looking at his watch over there. So time is up. That's good. Yeah, Tom's question.
Okay, Sante, are there any questions?
Yeah.
Michael from the Theon tradition.
Mm-hmm.
I don't certainly know any answers, but it's just an observation. Looking at that there seems to be a correlation. You can see a correlation between the Christian churches. But in one group that I've done some research, the Masonic Lodge, saying things are very patriarchal,
yeah,
is that the danger is that they combine both status, keeping status, with holding the baton, you know, the tradition. And when they're combined, it's very powerful. But only recently here, a couple of months ago, we were getting a Dharma talk from an ordained member who stated that females could not reach nirvana in the body of a woman. They had to, could only reach it through death and then from a body of a male. So it seems to me that it's the same inculcated type of prejudice that is not part of the rhetoric, but is still held in, say, the Christian basis of why women shouldn't be ordained because, you know, they're out of Adam's rib. And in other words, they're not equal. The rhetoric might say that they're equal human beings, and a lot of, say, Zen philosophy, etc., would say that, you know, there is no difference. But that's not how it is in actually reality.
Yeah.
So I don't know how to combat that.
Yeah.
And the same in the Masonic bit of research, they're almost willing to go under rather than the traditional one, rather than code masonry, which is the other half of the population of the earth.
Interesting. And it's, you know, it's interesting with a group like the Masons, who actually started as a group which was trying to integrate, you know, they're trying to integrate different traditions. But yeah, that's very true. And it's very damaging. It's very destructive. This is one of the reasons why we it's not just an abstract discussion, but there are women who are hurt, you know, deeply hurt. And I know, because they usually contact me and tell me all about it, you know. And you invest a tremendous amount in your spiritual tradition, your spiritual teachers, yeah? And you put so much faith in them and dedicate so much time and effort. And then to find out that you're treated in such a way because you're a woman or something like that, it's very, very destructive on a deep level. And it sort of, it contacts and amplifies kind of pre-existing kind of problems which women may have from having experienced discrimination in various forms, yeah? And when they come in the spiritual environment, they think you're getting beyond that. Oh, now it's kind of evolved, we're talking about higher consciousness and so on, and then you find the same thing. And so there's almost like this feeling of despair that there's actually nowhere where you can escape from this kind of thing. But the other corollary of that is, and I was just reading Carol Gilligan, this feminist psychologist, and she actually phrased it very well, and the way she phrased it from her research actually correlates extremely well with what I've seen in Buddhism and what I saw at that congress with the Dalai Lama, is that patriarchy divides men against women, and it divides women against themselves. And I thought that was very, very true, because what happened at that conference was that the Tibetan nuns, the Himalayan, Nepalese, Tibetan nuns, were then protesting and saying, we don't want bhikkhuni ordination, right? We don't want equal rights, right? Equal rights is not, the Dalai Lama was saying equal rights, great, you know? The nuns were saying, no, equal rights is not something we're interested in, okay? And so they were opposed to then the Western bhikkhunis and so on. So there was a split, the women are split. And so within traditional Buddhist societies, there are a lot of women who find their sense of identity and their sense of place within the existing structure, you know. So they're defined in relation to the monks, yeah. And a lot of them are quite comfortable with that relationship, yeah. And so the existence of bhikkhuni is threatening not just to the monks, but threatening to the women as well.
It seems to me one of the problems here is that in the Pali text, whether they represent the teachings of the Buddha fully or not, they can never be certain. If there's different conservative systems operating there, gender relations are very, very hierarchical in the early texts, but even in the Sanskrit epics, there's a tremendous amount of ambiguity. It's women who are driving everything along. Gravity drives along the action, the Mahabharata, and the
river, and
so it's terribly interesting. But when you read the Terigata and the Taragata, in the Taragata, the monks are represented as extremely heroic figures overcoming all these odds. Whereas in the poems of the Taragata, the women are really struggling because they're in these oppressive households and so forth, and they go into the forest and someone threatens, you know, almost threatens to rape them in this context. It's a totally different different image, and I suspect that might have played out for quite a long time in these highly patriarchal societies. One suggestion I have, though, and it's certainly a pie in the sky, I think there would be a seventh council. I wonder if something could be done there. I mean, as I say, it's pie in the sky, because the first three councils just gave rise to more and more conflict.
More and more patriarchy, yeah.
There might be something that could be done. Because that would go over the local Mahasanghas into a larger body.
Yeah, you're right, these pines, right? But I don't think there has been a genuine council of the whole Buddhist communion certainly since the Second Council. Yeah, I mean, after that it sort of breaks up, and whether the Second Council was genuinely representative, it quite possibly was, but certainly nothing after that. So yeah, I don't think there's really much chance of that. But also it's what I would like to do, and how I'm trying to sell it, is to try to renormalize everything. And so, well, actually, you don't need to change anything. Well, the bhikkhuni ordination procedure is there. The bhikkhunis are there from China. We don't need to change the rules. We don't need to change the vinaya. We don't need the permission of all the monks. We're just performing. There's, like, for those of you who don't know, the monastic code, we have a vinaya, a set of texts which delineates the monastic lifestyle, and that gives procedures for doing things like ordinations and so on and so forth. So that's all there. And all we have to do is follow that. And then, of course, all the objections to that are, well, they're Mahayanists, we can't do their ordination within the Theravada. But, of course, the concepts Mahayana and Theravada are not found within the vinaya itself. So these are imposed from later generations on earlier texts. Yeah? The vinaya was just the early community of Buddhist monks and nuns. They didn't have any schools and lineages and so on. So these words don't occur. The notion of lineage doesn't occur in the early texts. There's another thing that's very interesting. You know, all of these things that we rely on, or the monks rely on, to maintain their position, aren't there. Theravada isn't there. Lineage isn't there. Patriarchy isn't there. There's no power of command within the vinaya by individuals. Okay, so the only power of command is if the sangha gets together individually. So the bhikkhus or the bhikkhunis, the bhikkhus can get together and make a command to kick a bad monk out of the monastery or something like that as a whole. Or the bhikkhunis can make a command to kick a bad bhikkhuni out or give some kind of punishment. But there's no power of command where monks can order nuns around. Okay? And the nuns lived their own lives, built their own monasteries, did teaching, they taught kings, they taught, you know, they taught their own students, everything. And there's no power of control, but yet these days that power of control is always there. So those things are sold as vinaya, but they're not actually found in the vinaya. And the sad thing is, what is in the vinaya? You know, the whole vinaya was sparked by the Buddha's desire to teach out of compassion for the whole world. Yeah? Out of compassion for the whole world, that's what I'm going to teach. And so that's found in the vinaya. And we find these very beautiful passages where it says the monks should be always caring for each other, looking after each other with kindness and compassion, where the teacher should look on their student with the eyes of a father, and the student look on the teacher with the eyes of a son. Yeah? And these kinds of very beautiful passages, and these things are actually vinaya. These are actually what the texts say. And somehow they get forgotten.
As we were talking now, I just remembered my own ordination as a bhikkhu, which happened in a big Vietnamese temple outside of in San Diego in 2005. And it was very interesting that there was a group of monks in my tradition, which is the Vietnamese Zen tradition. We all were ordained bhikkhus together. And then following that, there was a group of bhikkhunis, or women ordained as bhikkhunis, from another Vietnamese monastery. And the ordination platform was made up of predominantly Vietnamese Theravada monks. So clearly in the world of what really happened, Theravada monks oversee happily the ordination of women as bhikkhunis. I found that very interesting. And the Mahayanas and the Theravadas were all hanging out together. Now, wasn't that something peculiar to Vietnam? I don't know. But
yeah.
I don't see why it wouldn't be generalized.
And it probably is, in a sense, Vietnam has that mix, but it has been generalized. And all these, of course, notions of purity of lineage and purity of school, of course, are just sheer fantasy. You know, we don't know anything really of what happens.
Yeah.
past. But yeah, this and this is actually like an almost like an unintended, what from my perspective, and I guess probably from your perspective, is an actual benefit of this concern with bhikkhunis, is that it makes us realize that there are these common roots and we can do those things together. Whereas from those who are more within the traditions, that's a threat. So you see this incursion, these kind of Mahayanists are going to leak into Theravada and spoil the pure tradition. So these concerns about purity and so on. And so this, you know, wanting to put up walls around. And like the dam that the Buddha said that he was had to build up to hold back the flood of women. Yeah? And so holding these walls around. So again, these two very, very different perspectives. So you've actually got, you know, it's what I think is you're getting these almost like two different kinds of sangha evolving, like one being the kind of the local traditional sangha who speak in their local language, who see themselves as preserving their local tradition and so on, and then you have like an international sangha who, or whatever you want to call it, who relate across traditions, across languages and so on and so forth. And again, this is one of the things that we saw at the conference in Hamburg, that, you know, when I went there, I would have more in common with the German nuns who were ordained in Tibetan tradition, yeah, than the than those Tibetan nuns would have with the, say, Nepalese nuns, yeah, in the same tradition. Yeah, so, yeah.
Any more questions?
I think it's important to realise that in the Theravada Vinaya about there's about 60 rules relating to monks in their relationships with women and how close they can get to women, whether they can go on a boat going upstream and this kind of thing. And one wonders why, I mean, there was a period of monks apprehension of their own sexuality, I suspect, which is common in the monastic traditions around the world. But it's interesting that about 30% of these rules relate to that, and there's another 30% relating to not the theft, but to taking what is adaya, that is what should not be given.
Yeah.
These apart from the most serious offences committed, but the less serious ones seem to relate to these two kinds of issues.
And food.
Food is
another big one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of rules about food. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And but in imagining, you know, if you if, I mean, those rules repay a detailed examination, but it's interesting, a number of things can comment. I mean, one thing is that the rules there, the rules as practiced in contemporary countries are very different from how they are again in the Vinaya. So, for example, the Vinaya has a rule against sexually groping a woman.
Mm.
Like, there's no rule against touching a woman, but there's basically a rule against, you know, groping or what we think of as, you know, sexual harassment or something. And but because these days in, say, a country like Thailand, and of course you can't touch a woman at all, and they go even so far as they won't, like, pat a female cat, you know? And if you're receiving something, a woman wants to offer you a glass of water or something, you have to put down a cloth and put that on, you know? So this is very, and like physical distance. Extraordinary things. I remember walking in Thailand down a road, not a path, a road, out of a monastery, and one of the village women is walking down over there. As soon as she sees me, she's like off the side of the road into the forest, yeah, because she won't come anywhere near a monk. Or another time when I was in, just a year or two ago, into Wanabumi Airport, and there's a row of seats, like 20 seats or something like that, connected metal seats. And there's a woman sitting, Thai lady sitting at one end of them, and I sit at the other end, and she immediately leaps off her seat. Yeah, so she's got this electric shock, you know. So there's this huge kind of taboo thing, which comes is a kind of the power of separation. Yeah? And it's actually the monks and women define themselves as a kind of binary pair in Thailand. So like you hear this kind of figure quoted that the number of monks and the number of prostitutes is the same in Thailand. Yeah. Now, whether it is or not, it's perceived in that way, yeah? And that's actually an ancient kind of Indian binary pair. Like even in the Arasa Shastra, it says that like if the king sort of wants to put spies into the community, the best professions for spies is monks and prostitutes, yeah, because they're the ones who people whisper their secrets to, yeah, and so there's this kind of, you get this binary pair, which is defined by a very strong line of separation, yeah, and so this allows Thai women to define themselves in a certain way, and also for the monks to define themselves in a certain way. And so it's interesting, you know, I mentioned the fourfold assembly, monks, nuns, laymen, lay women. So the nuns are out of the picture, basically. The laymen are also pretty much out of the picture in Thai Buddhism. Yeah, they don't participate very much. Yeah? It's basically the monks and the lay women are the two strong forces within Thai Buddhism. And they have a yeah, very strong kind of binary relationship there.
Maybe it's say the lady jumped off the stick, maybe Nante, you're underestimating your own charisma.
Could be, yeah. It happens a lot, yeah.
Okay, thank you Nante very much. I had originally intended to read this paper, but...